Offices have a responsibility throughout their entire value chains to respect human rights. If you can apply pressure at the top of the supply chain strategically, then you can achieve change at the bottom.
You are listening to Radio Atticus,
your national program on the law in the name of social justice.
This is obviously a live issue, and we need to start to talk about how we might regulate it here so that we aren't outsourcing our problems.
People are curious. They look at you and they want to know your story.
Radio Atticus, more than the vibe.
Hello and welcome to your national program on the law and social justice here on Radio Atticus. I'm your host, Anna Marie Reyes. In this edition, we spend some time looking close into your online life. We do a story about a new and perhaps a less threatening way to file for a divorce through an app developed by a family lawyer. First, we bring you the latest on your online goods. You must have heard it's been on the pipeline, our lawmakers imposing goods and services tax over those products we tend to purchase from overseas. It may be shoes, cosmetics, fashion items, clothes, and whichever that falls under the $1,000 price bracket. University of New South Wales Business School lecturer in taxation and business law, Catherine Bain, says there's more to it than meets the eye.
Currently, if you purchase products from overseas, so whether that's generally speaking online, if they're under $1,000, there's no GST that needs to be paid on those goods. If the products are over $1,000, they will be stopped at the border, and then the person who has imported the goods, so the purchaser of them, will need to pay the GST that's due, any customs duty, any other border processing fees before those goods are actually released and sent to the person.
Goods and services tax, is that collected by the government on behalf of its citizens?
It's collected by the suppliers. So basically the supplier of the goods or services. So when you go to a supermarket, the supermarket will be collecting the GST because it's built into the prices if GST is to be charged on the products, and they will be responsible for sending that to the Australian Taxation Office, the ATO. It's collected at a federal level, but in Australia it's distributed then to the individual states.
What was the importance of introducing GST in Australia?
Well, we've had GST since 2000. Essentially, before that point, we had wholesale sales tax. I'm first to admit that was before my time, and I've never really had much to do with that. But there was a lot of different rates of tax. It was a lot more complicated. So GST was meant to be across the board, a broad-based, low-rate consumption tax. So applied to basically all goods and services, even though we do now have a lot of exemptions, and you know, be able to be at a low rate.
And are you aware at all if some of the reasons that was introduced historically is because to try and control or create profit or make people more responsible about their consumer goods consumption?
That may have been an effect, but I think realistically it was a way to make sure that the government did have a fairly stable source of revenue. It did also mean they could lower income tax rate. And when you look at some other countries that do have a GST or a value-added tax, is what it's often called, Australia's 10% rate is incredibly low. It's one of the lowest in the OECD countries, so countries that are part of the Organisation of Economic Cooperation and Development. So we have kept that very low rate.
What are low-value imports?
If you currently purchase something from overseas and it has a customs value of less than $1,000, then it's considered a low-value import and there's no GST that needs to be paid on it. So why that is considered an issue is because Australian retailers think that this is unfair, because if I go to a shop in Australia and buy a product, I have to pay GST. If I purchase the same product from overseas, assuming it was less than $1,000, then I wouldn't have to pay GST on it. So the reforms that have been spoken about recently is looking at abolishing that threshold. So all goods, regardless of their value, would be subject to GST, even if they're purchased from overseas.
It would basically defeat the purpose for a lot of people who do buy low-value imports, because a lot of people who have very limited income, for example, young people, parents who have very little income margins, they would tend to buy things online that they can't afford in the shop.
Well, it would depend where they're buying it online. If you are buying something online from Australia, then it will already have GST on it. So this will only affect if you're purchasing things from overseas. In terms of whether that will impact on people's purchasing behaviour and things like that, Australian retailers for a number of years have argued that, oh, well, people are buying things online because they don't have to pay GST, they'll go to these overseas retailers. Realistically, while I think price is a big factor when people are deciding whether to buy something from overseas or in Australia, often it's a lot more than a 10% price difference. Because normally once you build in international shipping costs and things like that, there would need to be quite a significant price difference to make that worthwhile. And I mean, a lot of times people are buying goods from overseas simply because we don't have those product ranges in Australia. So I certainly think it's a valid concern of retailers. Theoretically, if I buy a product from Australia, it shouldn't be treated any differently than a product I buy from overseas. But I think it's going too far to say that, oh, people are buying things from overseas retailers purely because they don't need to pay 10% GST on it.
I've heard that there's been a reaction, for example, from online retailers like eBay, and they were even thinking of banning purchases from Australia due to this problem. Is it a problem about companies not wanting to pay tax, or is it something else?
In this case, it's not a case of companies not wanting to pay tax, because at the end of the day, it's not the company paying the GST. They're collecting it and they are sending it to the ATO, but it's the consumers that are actually paying it. Why eBay in particular is concerned is that the proposal that's been made by the government, and there's been legislation, although it hasn't yet been passed, it will require the overseas supplier, so the overseas seller of goods, to register into our GST system. So to start with, that imposes a lot of compliance costs on those retailers, because they won't know our system, they won't know what our GST really does in terms of how it operates. If they have any issues and concerns, they need to be getting in touch with the ATO, which is in a different country for them. For a lot of overseas retailers, it is just a concern about, well, what will our obligations be and will we be able to comply with these? eBay's concern is that they're not actually the seller of the goods. So eBay provides, obviously, the website, and they have the online marketplace, but it's a lot of times just individuals or smaller companies that are using eBay to buy or sell goods. So eBay's argument is, well, we shouldn't have to collect the GST because we're not the seller of these products. In Australia, if someone sells something on eBay, it's up to that seller to register for GST if they're required to. It really has nothing to do with eBay. The new law that's been proposed in relation to low-value imports essentially says that it is the electronic distribution provider, so the online marketplace, that will be considered to be the supplier, and they'll be responsible for collecting the GST. So that's why eBay has so many concerns, because they, in all reality, are not the seller of the product. They won't see the product. They don't physically collect any money. So they're taking the attitude, well, this really isn't our responsibility. And based on the way their systems operate, particularly since a lot of their products sold via auction, they have great concerns about how they would actually sort of build this into their systems, particularly since in Australia, the price, if it includes GST, that really needs to be shown in the price. You're not meant to add it on at the end. So they have a lot of concerns in terms of whether they would actually be able to comply with this law. And that's why they're making comments such as, well, they may just have to ban Australians from buying from overseas sellers.
Just to bring it down a little bit more onto the ground level, all I could think of in terms of low-value imports will be things like shoes or cosmetics, maybe fragrances, clothes, maybe used goods. But it sounds to me like they're mostly consumer items, And that would mean then that perhaps the most that could get hurt from introducing these is the consumer.
Well, yes, that's essentially correct, because it is consumer goods. If you run a business in Australia and you're importing, you know, a lot of goods from overseas to resell, for example, you'll already be paying GST because they won't be considered low value, and you would also be claiming that GST back as part of your business. So it really is just the individual consumers who will either be now paying GST on overseas products that they didn't have to before, or possibly not being able to access these products if your eBay does stop Australians from buying from overseas sellers, or if other websites follow that line of thinking.
You were raising concerns in your research. Can you just point out some of them, the main three in your research?
In terms of this proposal, originally, and this was actually before they had said that online marketplaces would have to register, because now that is probably my biggest concern. But in terms of when they first made this proposal, it's really concerns about compliance. So if you're an Australian business, you don't need to register for GST until your turnover is over $75,000 a year. The proposal in terms of low-value imports keeps that $75,000 threshold. So an overseas business will only have to register for GST if they have over $75,000 worth of sales to Australians. So the first concern is, well, how does the government know who those companies are? When the proposal had first been made by Joe Hockey, who was the treasurer at that time, he couldn't really give any definitive answers. He just made a vague, oh, there could be hundreds, we'll get some more data on that. So the first point is, well, how does the government know who is required to be registered? That then means when a product comes into Australia, there's one, no way for customs to know whether GST has been paid. There's nothing on any sort of mail declaration that notes that. So the second point is they won't know whether GST has been collected and really whether it should have been, because it may have been a case of, well, no, we didn't charge the consumer GST because we're under this $75,000 threshold and we don't have to be registered for GST. The third point then is, even if there is some way that customs has this information, so they can determine whether GST has been collected or not, there then would be concerns regarding whether that is being sort of correctly remitted to the ATO. Now, that is something that can be audited by the ATO, but when you're dealing with overseas businesses, it's a lot harder to go through those processes. And in terms of enforcing tax debts against a company that would have no presence in Australia, that is a very long and complicated thing to try to do, and generally would not be successful. So the three concerns really come down to knowing whether a company would need to be registered, whether they have collected GST, and then ensuring that if they are collecting the GST, that they are actually sending it to the ATO and the Australian government is actually getting that tax revenue.
It's interesting that this last point that you were raising too, Catherine, is that traditionally one of the biggest problems, and I remember Joe Hockey saying this in one of his speeches, is taxation over companies who have operations overseas. And if they're already having problems with those big ones, with big investments, I can imagine how difficult it must be in terms of making people, small operators, comply.
Exactly. And from the ATO's point of view, I mean, they have to sort of weigh up the costs and benefits before pursuing action. If we're talking about a company that is just over this $75,000 threshold, they will have collected less than $10,000 of GST. Now, that's not a particularly small amount of money, but if you look at the cost that would be involved from the ATO's point of view in auditing that company, trying to then get that money when they have no presence here, they may just decide, well, that's going to cost us more in time and in staff costs and things than we'll actually ever receive back in outstanding tax revenue.
I just needed to check in. What does GST do for generating good business and, practices that comply in the exchange of goods and sales of goods online?
It's not really ever something that is talked about too much in terms of generating good business practices. I mean, there is the argument that if you're complying with your GST operations, you'll usually have better records and that will help you in terms of your income tax obligations. I mean, it's really just the fact that, you know, GST is a necessary source of tax revenue for the government. It goes to states, it does fund hospitals, it funds schools. So we do need the government to be able to collect GST revenue. So certainly, if there was an easy way for them to collect it from overseas purchasers, then I honestly don't think that many consumers would have a problem with it. I mean, you know, obviously, no one really likes the fact that, oh, now I have to pay more tax. But a lot of times people realise that, well, tax is necessary. The government needs it to provide services. Where consumers really have a problem with overseas purchases is just, in a way, the hassle of then, well, if I buy a product from overseas, is it going to be stopped at customs? Or is the overseas shop I usually buy from going to say, oh, we're just not going to sell to you because you're in Australia and that's too difficult for us? So I think if there is sort of an easy way that we could purchase goods from overseas and still pay the GST, yes, people aren't going to be cheering in the streets that they have to pay 10% more. But I don't think they would be against paying that. It's more just ensuring that you're not also having to pay a whole bunch of processing charges, or that you still have those choices with overseas retailers.
University of New South Wales Business School lecturer in taxation and business law, Catherine Bain, and ending that interview. You're listening to Radio Atticus, broadcast nationally to the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2SER. I'm Anne-Marie Reyes.
I'm Michael Kirby, and you are listening to Radio Atticus. Radio Atticus is part of the Community Radio Network. I was formerly a Justice of the High Court of Australia with no time to listen to this, but now I sit glued to Radio Atticus.
In Trump's inaugural address, he promised to save America from crime and disorder.
This American carnage stops right here, right now.
Data editor of The Guardian US, Mona Chalabi, editor-in-chief of Slate, Julia Turner, lauded writer George Saunders, and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Colson Whitehead discuss Trump's progress at Sydney Writers' Festival, May 26, Sydney Town Hall. Tickets on sale at swf.org.au. Sydney Writers' Festival, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
So what's happening this week?
Have you ever seen laser beams in the sky?
What were you thinking?
I find an opportunity to lick Richard Wilkins.
Okay. Interviews and discussions and all sorts of interesting things. 107.3.
2SER.
In the modern and up-mobile age, coming from a divorced family is now a recognised reality. A Bureau of Statistics report in Australia says in 2015, couples file for divorce commonly at the 12th year of being together. Now, reporter Sophia Carvajal finds out about an app online which hopefully helps in making divorce less traumatic when inevitable in a relationship.
Breaking up is never easy, but for those of you thinking about divorce, there are now applications that can help you through that difficult process. In the past, divorce has taken its emotional toll on parents and especially children, as experience is stressful with the added tension of mounting legal costs and the adversarial approach of the family law courts. But now there's an Australian website and soon-to-be-launched app that can help you through divorce in a much more streamlined and economical way, according to Victorian startup entrepreneur and lawyer Anne-Marie Caird, creator of the Divorce Right website. She joins me now to talk about it.
Hi, Sophia. How are you?
Thank you.
For your call.
Can you tell me about your professional background? How many years have you been a lawyer?
Yes. Now, I actually studied law in Sri Lanka and practiced law for about 10 years there. Then I moved to Australia about 15 years ago, and I had to re-qualify as a lawyer and do articles all over again, and worked in a law firm, and then started my practice about 10 years ago. And in the course of my work over the years, I found that clients were very disgruntled with the situation when it came to handling family law matters, because I would do a lot of property settlements for clients, and primarily the cost involved with legal services and legal fees, you know, when it comes to family law matters. So I've been thinking there has to be a better way. Everybody
hurts. Let's go back a step, and can you take me through the steps of going through a divorce these days through the Australian court system typically?
So the minute someone has made the decision to separate from their spouse, they're going to think, oh, I've got to see a lawyer. And so they go see a lawyer and then they get involved in the adversarial process. Now, I find the adversarial process does not work for most people, especially with for people with children, you know, because that procedure, the court procedure, actually drives more conflict. 46% of marriages end in divorce, and a lot of the matters that actually go to court, eventually about 80 to 85% of those cases settle out of court. With family law, there's so much at stake, and we're dealing with children, we're dealing with emotions running high. Parenting is a lifelong responsibility. You may no longer be husband and wife, but you will continue to be mom and dad for the rest of your life. The adversarial system, I feel, pits people one against the other to determine a winner and a loser, and it pushes them apart rather than bringing them together in the best interests of the children. It's more important that parties actually put their differences aside and concentrate on the interests of the children, and this can only be achieved if the correct approach is adopted right at the beginning. It's better if they see a mediator, they see a child counselor, they see probably an accountant to decide on how the property settlement is going to be done. And then once they have sorted matters out, then they go to the lawyers, and then the lawyers give effect to that agreement. They must get the legal advice. But I feel that that should maybe come at a later stage where, you know, where the emotions are not as hot or heated as it is.
So you just described an ideal way of dealing with divorce. Is that how your new app would work?
Yes. So that's the approach I take. I want to aim to keep families away from court so that they can reach an agreement, maybe pursue options and work out arrangements that are practical for them. So what they do is the clients can get online. They get online on my website and provide, there's a secure online form. They provide all their information. What they do is they can do that from the comfort of their homes. They don't actually have to make an appointment with a lawyer or with me and, you know, or a mediator. They sit down and write their whole story. Once that comes through to me, we advise that they see their individual lawyers to get independent legal advice, but we tell them that they need to mediate their disputes or sit with a mediator, discuss the issues and try and reach an agreement.
So how about the cost compared to the traditional way of going to the family court?
See, the traditional way of going to court is very, very costly. It can cost a minimum of $50,000 to $60,000 per party. You know, if you're, and that's for maybe one or two court hearings, it is prohibitive, the cost. Whereas if you seek a collaborative approach, you can probably get everything done and dusted for probably $10,000 to $20,000 at the most if it is a little complicated. The other advantage of my approach is that, you know, the time factor, you probably have it all sorted out in about 3 months. Whereas with the court system, it's going to take 6 months to get a court date to begin with.
Is it safe and private to be uploading, you know, legal documents?
Yes. Now, with regards to the security aspect, we use a cloud-based practice management system. All documents are stored on the cloud. We also have a secure client portal. So that's part password protected, and there are patching systems and regular security audits.
So there are apps out there like this one, for example, Amicable iDivorce and Kit. In New South Wales, you can apply for a divorce online with an interactive form. What's the difference with divorce rights?
Now, even in Victoria, you can, if you want to get a divorce, you can get online if you've been separated from your partner for over a year, and you can apply for a divorce. You can make a joint application and you can get a divorce. But a divorce involves much more than just getting a decree divorce, you know. It involves children, it involves a property settlement, so that's where we get involved. And we help the partners negotiate and come to some sort of settlement. It's all out-of-court settlements, and like I say, we assist clients to save money and save their sanity in the process.
Do you think these kinds of apps for dealing with divorce and the law, that they'll become more common in the future?
I think so. I think the thing is, see, law, legal firms have been slow to adapt to technology, but the thing is, it's just a way, a new way of delivering legal services. And being innovative in the legal space is not just confined to adapting technology, but it also involves embracing creative, ways of thinking and applying your knowledge to creative ways of problem solving, which is what I think I'm doing. And I feel there's a crying need for this kind of services, especially in the area of family law, because it is a well-known fact that it's the conflict in a divorce that affects the children, not so much the divorce. So if we can reduce that and, you know, get parents to understand that, you know, if they can make the decisions in regards to that child and, you know, access and who's going to see that child and how they're going to, you know, arrange the time that they're going to spend with that child, and if they can do it cooperatively and be able to discuss it, that's far better than having a judge telling them that, you know, you're going to see your child on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and the mother's going to see the child the rest of the week, you know. It's far better if the parents can do it and make the decisions themselves and be more cooperative in their in the way they make those decisions.
What do you hope to achieve with your website and your app?
Yes, now I actually want to really make a difference in the way divorce is done. I'm quite passionate about what I do, and I really feel that, especially in the area of family law, I can make a difference because it is just all in the approach that I approach the problem. And there are a lot of families out there. If 80% of cases are getting settled out of court, there's no need to go down that path to begin with. They can, you know, start off by, you know, meet with a mediator, talking through their problems and try and achieve a workable solution.
So if people are interested in visiting your website, what's the website address?
Yes, it's divorceright.com.au, and once they send us through inquiry, then we'll contact them and we'll tell them how they can proceed.
That was Anne-Marie Cade, creator of the Divorce Right website and soon-to-be-launched app, about how there really is an app for everything, including divorce.
Sophia Carvajal with that report. You're listening to Radio Atticus, broadcast nationally through the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2SER.
The countdown is on to Budget Night, Tuesday, May 9, when Treasurer Scott Morrison will outline the government's plan for the nation.
2SER will be live in Canberra, ready to tell you how this year's budget will play out.
We'll bring you in-depth coverage and commentary from the nation's capital.
Starting from 7:30 p.m. Tuesday, May 9, on 2SER 107.3.
Hi there, I'm Jake Morecambe, one half of Gay Panic on 2SER. You can catch me and...
Hi. It's the guru of us, Jack Crane.
And yes, Jack, every Friday evening from 7 till 8. And on Gay Panic, we look at everything sex, sexuality and gender diverse and unravel all the LGBTIQ issues that make up the wonderful diverse rainbow that is our community. And yeah, like you heard, Jack is the guru of us. And to find out what that means, you'll just have to tune in every Friday evening from 7 with myself, Jake Morgan, and Jack Crane. That's Gay Panic on 2SER 107.3. See you there.
2SER 107.3. And this week we're probing the dark recesses of the mind.
Oogum boogum.
Very scary.
Did you wet yourself?
It could happen to you.
Stick around even if that scene does disturb you too much.
Well, I'm Gillian Triggs, and for legal news, facts and opinion, listen to Radio Atticus.
And that's about all for this edition. I hope you enjoyed our broadcast. If you want more, why not check out the podcast on www.2ser.com/Radio Atticus. You'll be able to hear the past 4 programs that went to air here on Radio Atticus. I'm Anne-Marie Reyes. See you until the next broadcast. Be safe on the roads and bye for now.